objecting to any reliable evidence concerning the historicity of Jesus. Suetonius could just as easily have confused a report that Christ, as a revelatory archangel, instigated the riots, or if a belief in or a preaching of Christ had done so, even if gospel-based. This, too, would be entirely compatible with minimal mythicism and therefore not a confirmation of historicity. The second passage in Suetonius is simply a casual and uninformative remark that, during the reign of Nero, quote, punishments were inflicted on the Christians, a class of men given to a new and mischievous superstition, end quote, which tells us nothing pertinent to the historicity of Jesus. It's even possible this sentence originally read Christians, later corrected in transmission, and thus referred to the Jewish rioters whom, as we saw, Suetonius reported had begun to make trouble under Claudius, the same possibility that we discussed for Tacitus. It's also possible that this line was an accidental interpolation of a marginal note summarizing the passage in Tacitus, although arguments made to that effect are not as strong as they sound, but neither debate is relevant to our present purpose. Even as is, the probability that there were Christians for Nero to persecute is the same on either historicity or myth, making this evidence of no use to us. Section 12. Missing Evidence, Contra Myth. That ends our survey of all the relevant evidence outside the New Testament. As you can see, it is not only dismal, but overall it actually counts against historicity. One final objection that might be attempted is that surely someone would have gainsaid the invention of a historical Jesus. But who? Do we have writings from them? We cannot make an argument from the silence of documents we don't have or from the silence of persons we can't identify. Since Christianity, like all mystery religions, would likely have employed exoteric myths to conceal secret esoteric doctrines from outsiders, as noted in Elements 13 and 14, and there is a significant decades-long gap in the early history of the cult where we cannot determine who survived or controlled the course of doctrine by the time the exoteric myths represented in the Gospels began circulating, as we noted in Element 22, we cannot know what anyone was saying about them, how they were first being used, or who would be in a position to know they weren't really true, or even if they would say so if they knew. Indeed, nothing was preserved from this period, even from sects we know disagreed with the communities that produced the epistles and gospels that we have. Yet we know there were many such sectarian schisms, as noted in Element 21. Since nothing they wrote or said was preserved, we have no way to know what those sectarian opponents gainsaid or what arguments they deployed to gainsay it, because we don't have any of their critiques of what later became the Orthodox sect. Indeed, we almost never have writings gainsaying mythical people when they are historicized. See again the examples of Moses, King Arthur, and Ned Ludd that I examined in Chapter 1. And yet we do have hints that some sectarian Christians were indeed gainsaying the new historicist reliance on the exoteric myths as actual histories. A hint of the existence of doubters of Jesus' historicity appears in the character of the Jewish opponent created by Justin Martyr in his fictional dialogue with Trypho in the mid-second century. Quote, but the Christ, if he has indeed been born and exists anywhere, is unknown and doesn't yet even know himself and has no power until Elijah comes to anoint him and make him appear to all. But you, on the basis of groundless hearsay, invent a Christ for yourselves, and for his sake you are now irresponsibly doomed, end quote. This could simply reflect a natural second-century Jewish criticism, not too unlike that found in the pagan critic Celsus of the same period, who argued, in his now-lost anti-Christian treatise that Origen critiques in Against Celsus, that the Gospels were the only evidence of historicity the Christians had, and yet were at best groundless hearsay. Celsus argues from the unproven assumption that they embellish a real story, while Justin's Trypho takes it one step further and suggests they might have been wholly fabricated. Notably, Justin's reply to this suggestion is simply that, quote, we have not believed empty fables or stories without any proof, but stories filled with the Spirit of God and bursting with power and flourishing with grace, end quote, which merely gainsays the charge without any proof offered. Indeed, the dialogue depicts Justin threatening to leave in a huff rather than actually presenting any evidence that Trypho was in any way wrong. They change the subject instead. More importantly, this looks very much like the response given to fellow Christians of some opposing sect in 2 Peter 1 and 2. This is a second century forgery passed off as written by the Apostle Peter, an example of how readily Christians fabricated not only their own history, but the documents attesting it, as I noted again in Element 44. Here we see an attack upon certain fellow Christians who were actually teaching that the story of Jesus was, as Justin also denies, a cleverly devised myth, and who were thereby creating a destructive heresy. Similar hints can be found in other forged epistles, for example, 1 Timothy 1 and 4, 2 Timothy 4, 1 John 1 and 4, 2 John 1, and so on. In 2 Peter, we also see a related anxiety over the strange celestial Jesus found in Paul's letters, to the extent that now only the properly informed were authorized to interpret them, according to 2 Peter 3. Obviously, the forgers of 2 Peter would have to represent these Christians as introducing a novel heresy. But in reality, these may have been Christians still connected to the original mysteries who knew the exoteric myths were only cleverly constructed allegories. The fact that this is all we ever hear of them demonstrates that we cannot expect to have heard more, for here, clearly, 2 Peter is attacking some Christian heresy we know nothing else about and have no documents from. Instead, we get a forged eyewitness testimony cleverly designed to refute the claim that the gospel was a myth, refuting it, that is, with a fabricated historical report. This letter is therefore a decisive proof of concept for the entire transition from the original Christian mysteries to a historicizing sect fabricating its own historical testimonies to prove its claims. The ascension of Isaiah is another example of this. We can tell the original redaction had Jesus die in outer space. It was therefore composed by a Christian sect who clearly adopted what I am calling minimal mythicism. But later, some historicizing Christians inserted a section that had Jesus incongruously die on earth at the hands of Pontius Pilate in a summary of their own fabricated gospel, as I noted in chapter 3. This appears to be what typically happened to the evidence. It was erased, doctored, or rewritten to support a historicist party line against a mythicist one. That this would inevitably happen, and that the eventually successful sects would typically be the ones who started treating the exoteric myths as historical fact, has been logically demonstrated by Kurt Knoll. Using the development of false claims of the historicity of certain figures and tradents in early Islam, Knoll shows that this is a common trend in the presence of intense sectarian competition over control of resources and ideology. An earthly Jesus known in the flesh would be a more effective tool for marketing a dogma than a revelatory cosmic Jesus would be. Therefore, as churches competed for authority, there would have been an inevitable pressure to invent an earthly Jesus known in the flesh. The cult thus moved away from revelation as primary toward placing mythical traditions as primary, which does indeed appear to be what happened, as we'll see in chapters 10 and 11. As Knoll concludes, quote, "The data betray a clear evolutionary process from the proclamation of the so-called Jerusalem pillars through the teachings of Paul and ultimately into several competing varieties of post-Pauline Christianity. Earlier Christian doctrinal modes went extinct as later ones evolved. The doctrinal mode favored by the Jerusalem pillars was extinct by the late first century. Although Paul's doctrinal mode was able to survive, it could do so only by evolving significantly new traits, including a conceptualization of a historical Jesus guaranteed by allegedly eyewitness testimonies. This newly invented historical Jesus effectively replaced Paul as the authority behind Paul's doctrinal mode," end quote. In short, it is more rhetorically effective to claim Jesus was a historical person, and that your doctrine can be traced back to him through a line of living witnesses and tradents, than to admit that everything known about Jesus came by revelation, which entails further revelations by upstarts and challengers, could carry the same value and thus could undermine the power of any growing church elite or the cohesion of any social mission. If Jesus was known only by revelation, one could preach anything and claim it was revealed. But if one claimed to be the keeper of a verified historical tradition, stemming from a real historical Jesus, one could argue against any new revelation that is not what Jesus said, because we have documents from men who were there and heard him, and we have men who claim to have known men who knew those men, and thus guarded the tradition. Hence we see this in Luke 1 and John 21. That this was indeed a later evolutionary development in the rhetorical battles among Christian sects is proved by Galatians 1, where Paul not only makes exactly the opposite argument, that human traditions were worthless and only direct revelations from the risen Jesus held any authority. But he also clearly feels compelled by his fellow Christians to say that, as we'll examine in chapter 11. It was evidently so commonly held at the time that human traditions were worthless and only direct revelations of value that Paul had to go out of his way to deny relying on human traditions and insist he had received his information by direct revelation instead. His audience in Galatia would accept no other argument from him and were evidently alarmed by some accusations that Paul had, gasp, relied on oral tradition, forcing Paul to remind them that he would do no such thing, and certainly never did, that in fact he relied only on direct revelations of the risen Jesus, the only source they evidently respected. But by the time 2 Peter was written, at least one major sect had completely reversed course on that point, and was warring against any continued use of direct revelation by insisting upon verifiable human tradition. A human tradition it freely fabricated, as that letter itself is an example of. We have already seen Origen admitting that this tactic had utility in mobilizing the obedience of the vast majority of what he called simpletons in the Christian movement, who, he claimed, were not sophisticated enough to grasp allegory, but needed to rest their faith on literal truths, as we examined in element 14. So there evidently was gainsaying after all. We just weren't allowed to hear much about it. Hence, the objection that we would have more evidence of it does not have merit. Clearly, the probability of that is too low to credit. It was all erased or destroyed or left to crumble into dust. This objection is also already refuted in principle. Inordinately public events are fabricated in the Gospels, such as a darkness covering the whole world for 3 hours, a wandering star that troubled the entire population of Jerusalem, a mass of resurrected saints invading the city, the triumphal entry of Jesus, a citywide earthquake shattering the very rocks, a very public, necessarily violent, large-scale vandalizing and clearing of the temple square, multiple miraculous feedings of thousands of people, the mass murder of 2,000 pigs, and a whole town of babies and toddlers, which are all obviously false, yet we have no extant document from anyone gainsaying any of it. Like, hey, I was there and I didn't see that. Therefore, evidently, we cannot expect there to be any. In fact, Jesus was said to have been famous all across not just Judea, but the whole province of Syria. We see this in Matthew 4, verse 24, Matthew 9, verses 26 and 31, Luke 4, verse 14. Yet we have no surviving record of anyone from those regions challenging this. Remarks like this create a logical conundrum for the historicist, for it is much easier to invent a man than to invent a famous man. Yet Jesus is depicted as incredibly famous in the Gospels. But if he were so famous, then the silence of other writers and historians about him, indeed the lack of any literature about him being generated by any of the thousands of contemporaries impressed or intrigued by his fame, as I surveyed earlier in this chapter, is all but impossible. That is, extremely improbable. The consequent probability of this pervasive and thorough silence on the hypothesis that Jesus actually was that famous, much less that any of the incredibly famous events associated with him in the Gospels actually occurred, and I gave only a select list of examples, is extremely small. So if the historicist wishes to maintain Jesus was really that famous, then historicity is refuted by the complete silence of all other literate persons of that age and region, and of all who wrote about that region or about any famous persons and events like those. The consequent probability of that evidence, of silence, is so small that it guarantees historicity will also have a very small posterior probability and must therefore be rejected as improbable. Just as for the darkening of the sun, as I have demonstrated before in my book Proving History, we can be sure that never happened, because if it did, someone would have mentioned it, other than just the Synoptic Gospels. It cannot be argued that someone would have gainsaid it, since that argument requires demonstrating someone existed who knew the truth and knew the Gospels, and cared enough to even bother gainsaying the wild claims in the fawning hagiographical texts of an obscure religious cult, and did so in writing, and that this writing would have been preserved, by medieval Christians, remember, for us to know of it now. We can identify no such person, and have no reason to expect the survival of any such record. Indeed, we know there surely must have been people who would gainsay the Gospels even with lies, yet none of their texts were preserved either, not even in quotation or rebuttal. The first we hear of anyone taking any notice of Christianity and taking any trouble to gainsay its claims is Celsus, who wrote in the latter half of the 2nd century, well over 100 years after the fact, half a century, then a whole lifetime, after any Gospels began circulating. And we know about that only because we have the rebuttal of Origen. The actual critique itself was not even preserved. Since no earlier responses to Christianity from any eyewitness critics have been preserved, not even in quotation, nor even by a mere mention, the probability that we would hear of an eyewitness gainsaying anything in the Gospels is effectively zero. The one instance of Matthew claiming the Jews were spreading tales that the Christians stole the body of Jesus cites no source, for example, nor any text, no name of anyone telling such a story, much less that they were present at the time, rather than from a later generation making up a skeptical explanation for what the Christians were by then claiming, and appears in an elaboration of the story in Mark that was certainly a fabrication and therefore never happened. In fact, as Mark shows no awareness at all that any such accusation of theft was being made, that accusation, if it was even made at all, appears to have been a response to Mark's invention of a missing body and not to anything being claimed during the previous 40 years of Christian evangelizing across 3 continents. We don't even have the Gospels saying that the very Gospels they are contradicting had it wrong. They just rewrite the story, hoping no one would notice. For example, John doesn't say the other Gospels were mistaken in placing Jesus' clearing of the temple at the end of his ministry rather than the beginning, much less cite any witness gainsaying it. He just rewrites the story, so that it occurs at the beginning of his ministry and not the end. Therefore, we must reject the argument that we would have witnesses gainsaying it. Obviously, we wouldn't. From all the considerations above, the probability of that is extremely low. We have no direct witnesses at all, gainsaying or not. It's already uncertain whether many would even have been alive by the time the exoteric myths gained anything like wide circulation, as noted in Element 22, especially if the myth began as an in-house secret symbolically representing a private revealed religion, as noted in Elements 13 and 14. But regardless, we have no texts or quotations of anyone present at the time who says anything whatever about the incredibly famous events declared in the Gospels, pro or con. We therefore cannot argue from what they would have said. Without them, or any references at all to them, we just don't know. The converse argument prevails. Such famous events would have been broadly attested, and Christians would surely have gleefully preserved such attestations. Yet they are not attested at all. So the historicist must accept that the reports of Jesus' incredible fame and all the incredibly famous things he was uniquely involved with are fabrications, legendary developments mapped onto what can only have been an actual fact of a very obscure, barely known figure who did nothing that won any attention among the literary elite. Hence, minimal historicity, as I explained in Chapter 2, is the only viable hypothesis. But that entails accepting massive legendary development had occurred, as I already explained in Chapter 6, which entails we cannot argue that no one could invent a historical existence for Jesus, since it is necessarily harder to get away with inventing a man's great and extraordinary fame than to invent a mere man. And the Gospels clearly succeeded in inventing a man's great and extraordinary fame, whether Jesus existed or not, so there would have been no obstacle whatever to their inventing the man altogether. Getting away with inventing an actual man's extraordinary fame without being gainsaid is indeed no harder than getting away with wholly inventing an extraordinarily famous man without being gainsaid, because inventing an obscure man is easy, and thus getting away with that would be not at all improbable. But to then embellish his story into incredible fame requires no more luck or effort than embellishing the story of an actual man into incredible fame. The two outcomes are equally likely to succeed. This means the consequent probability of inventing an actual man's extraordinary fame without being gainsaid, on minimal historicity, is essentially the same as inventing an extraordinarily famous man without being gainsaid, on minimal myth. Since these two probabilities are essentially identical, they cancel out, and thus add nothing to the argument for historicity or against. Section 13. Weighing the Evidence. When it came to the pervasive silence in other external documents, Christian and non-Christian, and the lack of many otherwise expected documents, I assigned no effect either way, although sterner skeptics might think that far too generous to minimal historicity. Conversely, as I just explained, no argument from silence can argue against minimal mythicism either. But the peculiar existence of two separate traditions about when Jesus lived, placing him a century apart, leaves us with a factor of 2-1 against historicity, or 50% against 100%, or at least 4-5, 80% against 100%. I also found the same for the content of 1 Clement. I also found that the content of Ignatius and the ascension of Isaiah was slightly more likely on mythicism than on historicity, by a factor of 4-5 at least, which is the same as saying there's an 80% chance we'd have material like that on historicity if it had a 100% chance on myth, or at worst, 1 in 2, which corresponds to 50% against 100%. And likewise, albeit less so, for the content of Hegesippus, by a factor of at least 9-10, for a 90% chance that that's what we'd find on historicity when there's a 100% chance of it on myth, although I think 4 in 5, or 80% against 100%, is closer to the truth. Everything else was found to be no more likely on historicity than on myth, and is therefore useless. Note again that these estimates discount random evidence loss. That is, when I say there is a 100% chance that we'd have something on mythicism, I mean, if it chanced to survive at all. Not that it certainly would have survived. The probability of its survival might be extremely low, but not the probability of its having existed, or something sufficiently like it. And it is the latter probabilities we are concerned with. On the validity of discounting the probability of survival because all coefficients of contingency cancel out, as well as the validity of every other aspect of the method here used, see my book Proving History. The probabilities here estimated assume that nothing about the extra-biblical evidence is unexpected on minimal mythicism. So the consequent probability of all this extra-biblical evidence on not H, in other words, minimal mythicism, can be treated as 100% across the board, whereas the probability of the same evidence looking this way on H, or minimal historicity, is 46% at best and 10% at worst. Either way, as a whole, the extra-biblical evidence argues against a historical Jesus. It's simply hard to explain all of its oddities on minimal historicity, but not hard at all to explain on minimal mythicism. Chapter 9. The Evidence of Acts. Section 1. Acts as Historical Fiction. The Book of Acts has been all but discredited as a work of apologetic historical fiction. Nevertheless, its author, traditionally Luke, the author of the Gospel, may have derived some of its material or ideas from earlier traditions, written or oral. But the latter would still be extremely unreliable. Note, for example, the condition of oral tradition under Papias, as discussed in the previous chapter. And it would be wholly unverifiable, and not only because teasing out what Luke inherited from what Luke chose to compose therefrom is all but impossible for us now. Thus, our best hope is to posit some written sources, even though their reliability would be almost as hard to verify, especially, again, as we don't have them, so we cannot distinguish what they actually said from what Luke added, left out, or changed. But that project has not gone well. Really, only one underlying historical source has been confirmed with any probability, and that's Josephus, who said nothing about Christ or Christianity, as we noted in Chapter 8. Luke simply used him for background material. That similar details also appear in his account of apostolic travels outside Judea suggests Luke may have used other historians of those regions to color those accounts as well. Those historians were simply not preserved for us to detect their influence now. All the other sources we can discern in Luke are literary, not historical. Those include what may have been a now-lost hagiographical fabrication, essentially a rewrite of the Elijah-Elisha narrative in the Old Testament Kings literature, but now casting Jesus and Paul in the principal roles. That is not what we would call a historical account. Its sources are not eyewitnesses or historical memory, but the Old Testament as a literary model and the imagination of the author reworking it. Thomas Brody argues that this evident reworking of the Kings narrative starts in the Gospel of Luke and continues to Acts 15. Indicating either that Luke wove this literary construct into his story or used an underlying source text, a previous gospel, that covered both the Acts of Jesus and the Acts of the Apostles in one book. So Luke took either this source text, or his own literary idea, or perhaps an early draft, and inserted more stories, thereby expanding it into two books, using material from Mark, Matthew, and perhaps other now-lost Gospels, as well as some of the epistles of Paul, and then continued the story from Acts 15 to Acts 28, which portion may have its own similar source text, or maybe Luke's own invention. The remaining sources we can discern are not hypothetical because we actually have them. For example, Dennis MacDonald has shown that Luke also reworked tales from Homer, casting them with new characters and giving them new outcomes as it suited him. For example, quote, "The shipwrecks of Odysseus and Paul share nautical images and vocabulary, the appearance of a goddess or angel assuring safety, the righting of planks, the arrival of the hero on an island among hospitable strangers, the mistaking of the hero as a god, and the sending of him on his way in a new ship," end quote. Paul himself says he was shipwrecked 3 times and at least once spent a day and a night adrift, 2 Corinthians 11, verse 25. Luke may have been inspired by this remark to invent a story about it, borrowing ideas from other famous shipwreck narratives, including those in Jonah, the Odyssey, and the Aeneid. Acts rewrites Homer several other times. Paul's resurrection of the fallen Eutychus is based on the fallen Elpenor. The visions of Cornelius and Peter are constructed from a similar narrative about Agamemnon. Paul's farewell at Miletus is constructed from Hector's farewell to Andromache. The lottery of Matthias is constructed from the lottery of Ajax. Peter's escape from prison is constructed from Priam's escape from Achilles, and so on. It is sometimes argued that the "we" passages, portions of Acts where the author inexplicably switches from the third person to the first person plural and back again, without ever explaining why or who we are, indicate an actual source. Some even argue those prove the author was an actual companion of Paul, but few scholars believe that's likely. It isn't what the author himself ever says, yet it was standard practice of the time to say so, if that is what the author meant to be understood. But fabricating a fictional narrative using I or we is already evident in the pre-Christian book of Jubilees, a made-up rewrite of Old Testament history adapted from Genesis, passed off as a revelation given directly to Moses, even though it was actually composed around the 2nd or 1st century BC. So the motif has an established precedent in historical fiction. A more famous model for writing fiction in the first person is the Odyssey of Homer, and notably, as MacDonald demonstrates, the we sections in Acts all center on sea travel. The author of Acts used many other literary sources as well. For example, the prison breaks in Acts share themes with the famously miraculous prison breaks in the Bacchae of Euripides. But the source Acts employs the most is the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. For example, while MacDonald shows the overall structure of the Peter and Cornelius episode is based on a story in Homer, Randall Helms has shown that other elements are borrowed from the book of Ezekiel, merging both models into one. Both Peter and Ezekiel see the heavens open, Acts 10 verse 11, Ezekiel 1 verse 1. Both are commanded to eat something in their vision, Acts 10 verse 13, Ezekiel 2 verse 9. Both twice respond to God, "By no means, Lord," using the exact same Greek phrase, "metamos kurie," Acts 10 verse 14 and 11 verse 8, Ezekiel 4 verse 14 and 20 verse 49. Both are asked to eat unclean food, and both protest that they have never eaten anything unclean before, Acts 10 verse 14, Ezekiel 4 verse 14. Obviously, the author of Acts is not recording historical memory here. He's assembling a story using literary structure and motifs from sources that have little or nothing to do with what actually happened to Peter or Paul. And he is doing this all to sell a particular, historically fabricated account of how early Christianity abandoned the requirement of Torah observance, one that made it seem approved even by Peter all along, complete with the confirming approval of divine revelation. When, in fact, we know from Paul, in Galatians 2, that Paul was for a long time its only advocate and was merely tolerated by Torah observers like Peter, often contentiously. In just the same way, Acts 15, verses 7 to 11, as Robert Price says, quote, "pretty much puts Paul's speech from Galatians 2, verses 14 to 21, into Peter's mouth," end quote. The exact opposite of what Paul tells us actually happened. Every other story in Acts is like this, a fictional creation woven from prior materials unrelated to any actual Christian history to sell a particular point Luke wanted to make. Maybe there was some authentic source material behind some of what appears in Acts somewhere, but how can we find it? From beginning to end, Acts looks like a literary creation, not a real history. It was written to sell a specific idea of how the church began and evolved. It is clear, as Joseph Tyson said, quote, "The author of Acts wanted to stress the continuity of Judaism and Christianity, Paul's close relation to the other apostles, and the unity of the first believers," end quote, and thus had to subvert the epistles of Paul, especially Galatians. For example, we know Paul, quote, "was unknown by face to the churches of Judea," end quote, until many years after his conversion, as he explains in Galatians 1, verses 22 to 23. And after his conversion, he went away to Arabia before returning to Damascus, and he didn't go to Jerusalem for at least 3 years, as he explains in Galatians 1, verses 15 to 18. Whereas Acts 7 to 9 has him known to and interacting with the Jerusalem church continuously from the beginning, even before his conversion. And instead of going to Arabia immediately after his conversion, in Acts he goes immediately to Damascus and then back to Jerusalem just a few weeks later and never spends a moment in Arabia. And yet we have the truth from Paul himself. Clearly the author of Acts was not writing actual history, but revisionist history, which we call pseudo-history. He simply made things up, with little real care for historical accuracy or fact. Besides what we've already seen, the most obvious example of this is Luke expanding Jesus' post-resurrection stay on earth to an incredible 40 days of hanging out with his disciples and more than 100 other believers in secret the whole while, teaching them daily, even more apparently than he could think to teach them while alive, and then flying up into outer space to the accompaniment of angels, Acts 1 verses 3 to 12. This is myth, not history. Burton Mack gives another example of how Luke's version of the history of early Christianity in Acts is wholly unrealistic. He says, quote, "Luke says that the standard sermon was preached to the Jews on the day of Pentecost and often thereafter, whereupon hundreds converted and the world became the church's parish overnight," end quote. But this is, quote, "a story that does not make sense as history by any standard," end quote. Not only in respect to its absurdly hyperbolic growth, but even just in the context of how people would really behave. As Mack puts it, quote, "No Jew worth his salt would have been converted when being told that he was guilty of killing the Messiah. No Greek would have been persuaded by the dismal logic of the argumentation of the sermons. The scene would not have made sense as history to anyone during the first century with first-hand knowledge of Christians, Jews, and the date of the temple in Jerusalem. So what do we have on our hands? An imaginary reconstruction in the interest of aggrandizing an amalgam view of Christianity early in the second century. Luke did this by painting over the messy history of conflictual movements throughout the first century and in his own time. He cleverly depicted Peter and Paul as preachers of an identical gospel. That is myth-making in the genre of epic. There is not the slightest reason to take it seriously as history." End quote. In short, the narrative we have in Acts is so unrealistic, it cannot have been based on anything that actually happened. It's what Luke wishes to have happened, maybe what he wants people to believe happened, but it's certainly not what happened, even in outline. And as for this instance, so for all others in Acts. This conclusion should not surprise us, since all other Acts literature written by Christians was wholly fabricated as well. The Acts of Peter, the Acts of Paul, the Acts of Andrew, the Acts of John, and the Acts of Thomas all look substantially like the Acts of the Apostles in the New Testament, yet are obviously not based on any kind of history. They are literary creations, telling stories the authors wanted using known legendary characters, the various apostles after which they are named, plus in each its own cast of characters, some historical, some mythical, some invented to the purpose. There is really no reason we should privilege the Acts in the New Testament as somehow more historical or more reliable than any of these others, which were all written within decades of each other. Indeed, for this very reason, we should have presumed Acts to be fiction all along, albeit historical fiction, just like the Maccabean literature before it and other purported works of religious history, as noted again in Element 44. Prior probability favors no other conclusion. The literary coincidences in Acts are also too numerous to be believable history, and reflect the deliberate intentions of the author to create a narrative that served his purpose. For example, as Robert Price observes, quote, Peter and Paul are paralleled, each raising someone from the dead, Acts 9 verses 36 to 40 and Acts 20 verses 9 to 12, each healing a paralytic, Acts 3 verses 1 to 8, Acts 14 verses 8 to 10, each healing by extraordinary magical means, Acts 5 verse 15, Acts 19 verses 11 to 12, each besting a sorcerer, Acts 8 verses 18 to 23 and Acts 13 verses 6 to 11, and each miraculously escaping prison, Acts 12 verses 6 to 10 and Acts 16 verses 25 to 26, end quote. Similarly, just as Peter is sent by God to save Cornelius when Cornelius sends for him after a vision in Acts 10, Paul is sent by God to save the Macedonians, quote, when a certain Macedonian man, end quote, sends for him in a vision, Acts 6 verses 9 to 10. Luke makes Paul's story parallel Christ's as well. As Robert Price says, quote, both undertake peripatetic preaching journeys, culminating in a last long journey to Jerusalem, where each is arrested in connection with a disturbance in the temple. Then, each is acquitted by a Herodian monarch, as well as by Roman procurators, end quote. Both are also plotted against by the Jews, and both are innocent of the charges brought against them. Both are interrogated by, quote-unquote, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin. And both know their death is foreordained and make predictions about what will happen afterward, shortly before their end. But Paul does almost everything bigger than Jesus. His journeys encompass a much larger region of the world, practically the whole northeastern Mediterranean. He travels on and around a much larger sea, the Mediterranean rather than the Sea of Galilee. And though, like Jesus, on one of these journeys at sea he faces the peril of a storm yet is saved by faith, Paul's occasion of peril actually results in the destruction of a ship. Likewise, Paul's trial spans years instead of a single night, and unlike Jesus, veritable armies plot to assassinate Paul, and actual armies come to rescue him. While Jesus stirs up violence against himself by reading scripture in one synagogue, Paul stirs up violence against himself by reading scripture in two synagogues. The parallels among these three synagogue incidents are even more numerous and obviously intentional, as John Dominic Crossan shows in his book, The Power of Parable. However, whereas Christ's story ends with his gruesome death, which had a grand salvific purpose which could not be claimed for Paul's ultimate death, and which, to end well, had to be followed by a once and final resurrection, something that could also not be claimed for Paul, Paul's story ends on a conspicuously opposite note. Quote, and he abode 2 whole years in his own hired dwelling, and received all that went to him, preaching the kingdom of God, and teaching the things concerning the Lord Jesus Christ, with all boldness, and none forbidding him, end quote. Something even Jesus could not accomplish when he was in Roman custody. Thus, Paul outdoes Jesus even in that. Paul and Jesus also both die and rise again from the dead, yet unlike Jesus, Paul actually stomps right back into the city unmolested and continues to publicly preach throughout the land, winning many more disciples for Jesus, Acts 14 verses 19 to 21 and thereafter. In contrast, Jesus wins no new disciples after his resurrection and doesn't even try. And all this occurs immediately after Paul, also just like Jesus, is hailed as a god. And yet again, Paul outdoes Jesus by humbly denying the claim, Acts 14 verses 11 to 18. And in the end, Paul, unlike Jesus, is sent to meet the emperor of Rome, something even Jesus did not accomplish. In other words, by Luke's account, Paul was vastly more famous and successful than Jesus. The extent of the parallels drawn between Peter and Paul and between Paul and Jesus are altogether improbable as history. Likewise, the account of Paul's conversion in Acts 9 verses 1 to 20 is simply a rewrite of the Emmaus narrative in Luke 24 verses 13 to 35, which, as we'll see in chapter 10, is obviously mythical. 1. Both stories feature a journey on a road from Jerusalem to another city, Emmaus in Luke 24, Damascus in Acts 9. 2. Both stories feature a revelation of Christ. 3. In Luke, the revelation came as, quote, they drew near, end quote, the city, where, quote, they were going, end quote. Luke 24, verse 28. While in Acts, the revelation came as Paul drew near the city where he was going. Acts 9, verse 3. 4. In both stories, Jesus appears and rebukes the unbeliever and instructs him. And as a result, they become believers and go on to preach their newfound faith. 5. In both stories, there are at least three men on the road together, and yet only one of them is named. Paul as Saul in Acts, Cleopas in Luke. Though in Luke, the third man on the journey is Jesus walking along in disguise, he never tells anyone his name. Whereas in Acts, Jesus appears as a light from heaven, but Paul is accompanied by at least two unnamed men. 6. In both stories, the chief priests of Jerusalem are the named enemies of the church. And 7. In Luke, God says Jesus had to suffer, while in Acts, God says Paul had to suffer. 8. Both stories feature blindness. Paul is blinded by the divine light of his vision in Acts 9 verse 8. Cleopas and his companion's eyes are blocked from seeing that their fellow traveler is Jesus in Luke 24 verse 16. 9. Both stories end with this blindness being lifted. 10. In Luke, the visitation occurs on the third day. In Acts, the visitation is followed by a blindness of 3 days. And 11. In Luke, the blindness ends after a meal commences, while in Acts, a meal commences after the blindness ends. The author of Acts also uses features of the John the Baptist narrative to construct Paul's conversion story. First, the names of John the Baptist and Ananias, who restores Paul's sight, mean the same thing in Aramaic. John, Yohannes or Yahuhanan, Yahweh is gracious, and Ananias, Anan Yas, Hanan Yahu, gracious is Yahweh. It's the same name, just with the words reversed. Second, John says, quote, "Prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight," end quote. And so Paul takes shelter on Straight Street, Acts 9 verse 11, after attempting to destroy the way, Acts 9 verse 2, but instead sees the Lord in the way, Acts 9 verse 27, and takes up the cause of preaching the way. Third, and finally, the initial order of events is almost exactly reversed. God speaks to Paul in a vision from heaven, then Paul prays and is baptized, then goes on to preach the gospel. Jesus is baptized, then prays, then God speaks to him in a vision from heaven, and then, in this case, just like Paul, goes on to teach the gospel. The order of events is the same, but reversed. Luke has also taken elements from the book of Tobit. When Paul is healed after his blinding vision by Ananias acting on God's orders, we're told, quote, "Immediately the blindness fell from his eyes like scales, and he saw again and rose and was baptized," end quote. In Tobit, the angel Raphael is told by God to scale away Tobias's blindness. Literally, the text of Tobit says, to scale away the whiteness, as Tobias's eyes had become clouded with white. So here, scaling away the whiteness makes sense, whereas there is no intelligible reason why Paul's blindness should be described as like scales, except as an allusion to the tale in Tobit, which also involves a story of traveling on a road with a divine being in disguise, in this case an angel, on a mission that would result in saving lives. And just as Paul is given letters from the high priest authorizing him to arrest Christians in Damascus, Tobias was given a letter from his father authorizing him to claim a deposit of money, also like Paul, in a foreign city. More tellingly, the angel accompanying Tobias poses as, quote-unquote, the son of Ananias, and provides the means to cure the blindness of Tobias, just as in Acts, the analogous divine being, the Lord Christ, provides the means to cure the blindness of Paul through a man named Ananias. Other descriptive elements of Paul's encounter on the road also derive, more loosely and creatively, from Ezekiel and Daniel. For this to be history, one has to posit all these agreements and parallels are historical coincidences, which is far less probable than that they are inventions, intelligently designed to reflect each other. And when you remove them all, you have no real story left to call authentic. Any one or two or even three of these parallels or coincidental details could be historical at a stretch, but not all of them together. Maybe there is some historical core to either or both tales that has been dressed up with all these fabricated symbols and coincidences and tall tales, but we have no way of knowing what that core might be, or even if there is one. Therefore, these stories cannot be relied upon as evidence of any historical fact, beyond the vaguest of generalizations, such as that Jesus may have originally appeared as a divine heavenly light, or that Christians may have believed God could visit them in the guise of an ordinary stranger. But such conclusions are neither certain nor helpful to the present purpose. The same kind of analysis repeatedly destroys every narrative in Acts. I've presented only a few examples. But even in general, Acts shares too many features with popular adventure novels of the same period to warrant trusting it as a genuine history. 1. They all promote a particular god or religion. 2. They are all travel narratives. 3. They all involve miraculous or amazing events. 4. They all include encounters with fabulous or exotic peoples. For example, as Robert Price says, quote, bull sacrificing pagans of Lycaonia in Acts 14 verses 8 to 19, superstitious natives of Malta in Acts 28 verses 1 to 6, and philosophical Athenian dilettantes in chapter 17, end quote. As well as fanatical pagan silversmiths of Ephesus in Acts 19 verses 23 to 41, and so on. 5. They often incorporate a theme of chaste couples separated and then reunited. A token nod to this element exists in Paul's chaste interaction with Lydia in Acts 16 verses 13 to 40, and his many women followers, named and unnamed. 6. They feature exciting narratives of captivities and escapes, as in Acts 12, Acts 16, Acts 21, and Acts 26. And 7. They often include themes of persecution. 8. Scenes involving excited crowds who become a character in the story, as in Ephesus and Jerusalem, in Acts 18 to 19, and 6 to 7, and 21 to 22. And 9. Divine rescues from danger are included. And 10. Divine revelations are always integral to the plot, through oracles, dreams, and visions, all of which feature in Acts. In fact, Acts looks far more like a novel than any historical monograph of the period. A table is provided in Richard Pervo's book, The Mystery of Acts, where he enumerates 10 different respects in which Acts is notably unlike ancient historiography, yet all 10 are commonly encountered in ancient fiction. If Acts looks exactly like an ancient novel, and it does, are we really going to chalk this up to coincidence? Section 2. What happened to the body? So the canonical Acts is not really to be trusted any more than any of the other apocryphal Acts that Christians produced. But let's at least suppose that its author started with some sort of bare outline of what happened in the early years of the spread of Christianity, and maybe even some actual historical sources or semi-historical sources, perhaps something with a historical core embellished with legends and tall tales, even if he didn't use them very much. At the very least, let's assume such materials and information were known to him, even if he didn't use them at all. Surely even then he would take them into account and be inspired by their content when constructing his own story of what happened. Whether we grant such assumptions or not, Luke obviously constructed tales affirming the historicity of Jesus, as well as the physical resurrection of his corpse, which left behind a conspicuously empty tomb, got touched by the disciples, slept and dined with them during a secret 40-day closed-door conference, and then flew off into outer space before their very eyes. Just read Luke 24 and Acts 1. This is all obvious nonsense. Notably, no witnesses are claimed for any of this but fanatical followers. No one else is reported to have verified any of it. Instead, the public history of the Christian mission begins only in Acts 2, which depicts the first time Christians publicly announced their gospel. But something very strange happens at that point. In Acts' history of the movement, from the movement the flock first goes public, in the very city of Jerusalem itself, at no point in the story, anywhere in all subsequent 27 chapters spanning 3 decades of history, do either the Romans or the Jews ever show any knowledge of there being a missing body. Nor do they ever take any action to investigate what could only be to them a crime of tomb robbery and desecration of the dead, both severe death penalty offenses, or worse. The Gospel of Matthew even claims the Jewish authorities accused the Christians of such crimes before Pilate himself. Just look at Matthew 27, verses 62 to 66, Matthew 28, verses 4, and verses 11 to 15. Although that is certainly fiction, as I have argued elsewhere, external and internal evidence confirms Matthew's story as a poetic and apologetic fabrication, it does reflect what could not fail to have happened if anybody had actually gone missing. Since Christians were supposedly capitalizing on this fact, that is, a missing body as evidence of a risen Jesus, they would be the first suspects, or at least the second, if, as the Gospels claim, Joseph of Arimathea was really the last person known to have had custody of the body. In that case, he would be the first man hauled in for questioning, Yet he vanishes completely from this, the earliest, history of the church, as if no one knew anything about him, or he didn't exist at all. Yet unless he was found and confessed to getting rid of the body, the Christians would be next in the dock. And yet, though Christians would certainly be suspects in a capital crime of grave robbery, and though Acts records case after case of them being interrogated at trial before both Jews and Romans on other offenses, for example, Acts 4, 5, 6, 7, 18, 17, 23, 24, 25, 26, etc., never once in this entire history of the church are they ever suspected of or questioned about grave robbery. It's as if there was no missing body to investigate, no empty tomb known to the authorities, which means the Christians can't really have been pointing to one. If they had, they would have been questioned about it and possibly convicted for it, innocent or not. Yet Acts shows there were no disputes at all regarding what happened to the body, not even false accusations of theft, or even questions or expressions of amazement. The Romans, meanwhile, would have had an even more urgent worry than body snatching. The Christians were supposedly preaching that Jesus, even if with supernatural aid, had escaped his execution, was seen rallying his followers, and then disappeared. Pilate and the Sanhedrin would not likely believe claims of his resurrection or ascension, and there is no evidence they did. But if the tomb was empty, and Christ's followers were reporting that he had continued preaching to them and was still at large, Pilate would be compelled to haul every Christian in and interrogate every possible witness in a massive manhunt for what could only be, in his mind, an escaped convict, not only guilty of treason against Rome for claiming to be God and king, as all the Gospels allege, but now also guilty of escaping justice. And the Sanhedrin would feel the equally compelling need to finish what they had evidently failed to accomplish the first time, finding and killing Jesus. Yet none of this happens. No one asks where Jesus is hiding or who aided him. No one is at all concerned that there may be an escaped convict, pretender to the throne, thwarter of Roman law and judgment, dire threat to Jewish authority, alive and well somewhere and still giving orders to his followers. Why would no one care that the Christians were claiming they took him in, hid him from the authorities, and fed him after his escape from justice, especially according to Acts 1, unless, in fact, they weren't claiming any such thing? This is enough to confirm Acts' account of events is a fabrication, and a rather unrealistic one at that. Thus, either Acts deliberately suppresses the truth about what happened to the body and what was really being argued, said, and done about it, which eliminates Acts as being of any historical value, or there was no missing body and no one was claiming there was. The fact that Acts fails to mention any debate or investigation or discussion about any tomb being empty or any body being missing, it never even occurs as an argument or a defense in any of the trials or debates that Acts records, for instance, or likewise about an executed convict being reported alive and well, would agree with the theory that the original Christians were in fact preaching that Jesus rose in an entirely new body, not the old one he discarded and left behind in the grave. As Paul wrote, the body that dies, quote, is not the body that is to come, end quote, but rather the buried body is left to be destroyed, while a superior replacement body is already stored up in heaven waiting for us, as we see in 1 Corinthians 15, 35-50, and 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1-4. Note that even Peter's street sermon in Acts 2, which references David's tomb, fails to make any appeal to the actual emptiness of Jesus' tomb, nor does anyone present affirm its emptiness or challenge it. It simply doesn't even come up. So Acts' account could perhaps be rescued on minimal historicity. A real historical Jesus could still have been in his grave, which would not really have been a private grave owned by Joseph, but the graveyard owned by the court for the burial of convicted criminals. And Acts source materials could, for that reason, lack any mention of inquests or disputes over the missing body, because there wasn't one. Of course, these omissions could instead be because the author of Acts, in fabricating his story, simply didn't think about having the authorities or even the evangelists behave realistically. But if there was no missing body, that could well be why the claims of his resurrection are dismissed as mere madness, as in Acts 26, verse 24, involving no possible criminal charge of any kind under Roman law, as we're told was repeatedly said, for example, Acts 18, verses 12 to 17, Acts 23, verses 26 to 35, and so on. Otherwise, the crime of either robbing graves or aiding and abetting an escaped felon and royal pretender would certainly have been obvious grounds for an inquest or trial, yet neither occurs. Thus, if Acts records any truth about history of the first church, its narrative all but entails there was no empty tomb, the body of Jesus was not missing, and that the earliest Christians, including Paul, were instead preaching a resurrection by transfer to a new body, now in heaven, a fact known only by private revelations and interpretations of Scripture, which would be dismissed by Roman and Jewish authorities alike as nothing but vain superstition at best, idle madness at worst. So evidently this detail is a wash. Both historicists and mythicists can adduce equally plausible explanations of it, though only by assuming the first Christians were not preaching an empty tomb. But there is something even stranger missing from Acts. Section 3. The Mysterious Vanishing Acts. The second peculiar thing about Acts is how thoroughly all the people associated with a historical Jesus, as opposed to a cosmic revealed Jesus, disappear from the historical record entirely. This a historicist cannot plausibly explain. Not only do Pontius Pilate and Joseph of Arimathea immediately vanish from Christian history, Pilate alone gets mentioned only as the crucifier of Jesus and only in speeches by Christians echoing Luke's gospel. So also disappears Simon of Cyrene and his sons, and Martha and her brother Lazarus and Nicodemus and Mary Magdalene. From Acts 2 on, none of these people is ever mentioned or ever does or says anything, nor is their departure or lack of involvement ever noted or explained. But also vanishing is the entire family of Jesus. Even though Jesus' mother, Mary, and his brothers are explicitly said to have joined the church congregation in Acts 1 verse 14, as soon as Christianity becomes public news, they immediately vanish from history, completely. As does Jesus' father, Joseph, though his omission in Acts 1 verse 14 could be taken to imply he had died, although it is at least a bit strange that that fact never gets mentioned anywhere. Likewise, we might explain away the disappearance of his sisters, which he is supposed to have had, according to Mark 6 verse 3 or Matthew 13 verse 56, by supposing their insignificance, but his mother and brothers? The disappearance of some characters can readily be accepted by a historicist as being a consequence of their never having existed. Joseph of Arimathea, for example, could readily be dispensed with without impugning the historicity of Jesus. The absence of major characters introduced by John, Lazarus and Nicodemus, who already don't appear in any prior gospel, much less Acts, can be explained away even more readily as inventions of John. Their importance and connection with Jesus is so prominent in his gospel that their absence even in prior gospels is already sufficiently inexplicable. And there is other evidence of their non-existence, even more decisive, likewise for other named characters, as I'll show in chapter 10. But Pilate's absence cannot be explained in such a way. Certainly, if Pilate never had anything to do with the death of Jesus, his absence from Acts sources for the early Jerusalem church is easily explained. Somewhat less so otherwise. So this disappearing act agrees fully with minimal mythicism, but is at least slightly unexpected on minimal historicity. It's the complete disappearance of Jesus' family that is really hard to explain on minimal historicity. After the report of her being with the congregation in Acts 1 verse 14, Mother Mary is never mentioned again. She never says or does anything, is never spoken to or heard of again, and nothing ever happens to her. We aren't even told when or why or where she lived or died. She literally disappears from history, as if she never existed. Though Acts 1 verse 14 also says Jesus' brothers were present just weeks before the Pentecost announcement recorded in Acts 2, all of his brothers then disappear. They are never mentioned again. According to Acts, they had no role at all to play in the history of the church and are never heard from. No one even seems to be aware they exist. This includes most conspicuously his brother James, who is supposed to have been one of the most important leaders of the movement, one of the three pillars on which the new church was founded, if that is what we are to understand Galatians 1 verse 19, Galatians 2 verse 9 or 12 to mean, or 1 Corinthians 15 verse 7 as many scholars insist or suppose. I'll discuss whether that is what Paul actually meant in chapter 11. But later legend certainly had Jesus' brother James lead the church in precisely the time covered by Acts. So why is he not in it? The entirety of Luke Acts mentions only two men by the name of James, yet identifies neither as the brother of Jesus. To the contrary, it specifically distinguishes both of them from his brothers in Acts 1 verses 13 to 14. One of them is indeed one of the three pillars named by Paul, Peter, James, and John in Galatians 2 verse 9, who was clearly not the brother of Jesus, as all the Gospels agree, but the brother of the other pillar, John. Acts says this James was beheaded by Herod Agrippa in Acts 12 verses 1 to 2. The only other James in Luke Acts is James the son of Alphaeus. We see him in Luke 6 verse 15 and Acts 1 verse 13, who must therefore